This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, the 5th of April, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast. In Ivory Coast, Laurent Gbagbo's compound in Abidjan is surrounded as he negotiates his surrender. As the Fukushima nuclear crisis continues, residents in the Pacific Northwest express renewed concern about the Hanford nuclear reservation.
We have this very large legacy of nuclear waste that has yet to be secured.
And civil liberties groups call on President Obama to veto any bill that extends controversial provisions of the Patriot Act. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The 2011 U.S. budget impasse continues with no deal reached this morning. House Republicans are now pushing yet another stopgap measure. This one would buy one more week, but would cost Democrats cuts to defense spending through September. The continuing resolution would also block D.C.'s local government from dipping into its own wallet to help poor women pay for abortions. And as this year's budget remains up in the air, House Budget Committee Chair Paul Ryan revealed their proposal for next year. It would cut $6 trillion over 10 years. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders calls the plan Robin Hood in reverse.
What I have been disturbed about in terms of the whole budget debate, whether it's the continuing resolution or fiscal year 12, is the need to bring revenue into the picture and to say we are not going to extend Bush's tax breaks for the very richest people. What we need is a surtax on millionaires. Last week, we announced that there were 10 corporations, 10 of the largest corporations in this country, who not only paid nothing in taxes, they got substantial rebates.
1 year ago today, 29 miners died in an explosion at West Virginia's Upper Big Branch mine. The results of an official investigation have not yet been released. The mine is owned by Massey Energy, a company that continues to be regularly cited for safety violations. Massey still denies responsibility for the disaster. In Haiti, election results are in, and popular musician Michel Sweet Mickey Martelly won the presidency with more than 67% of the vote. Martelly will replace term-limited President René Préval. The pop star turned president will take the reins in a country where 800,000 people displaced by last year's hurricane still live in tents. The International Criminal Court said today that Libyan leader Colonel Muammar Gaddafi planned to kill civilians to suppress an uprising before it even started. Today, Gaddafi's forces brutally repelled the rebels from Brega, even as NATO claimed to have taken out fully 30% of the pro-government armaments near the town. Brigadier General Mark Van Oom.
So what we now try to achieve is that we try to identify where those heavy assets like tanks and armored vehicles are, because we have seen that they have chosen to hide themselves into urban areas, even using human shields.
Van Oom confirmed that NATO killed civilians during airstrikes near Brega over the weekend, calling the incident an unfortunate accident. Violent unrest continued in both Yemen and Syria today. At least three more people died in Yemen during demonstrations in Taiz and Sana'a. And in the southern Syrian town of Daraa today, a general strike closed most businesses, and protests were expected to grow on the first day of a so-called Martyrs' Week. According to posts on Twitter, protests began in two more towns near Damascus, and two police officers were shot and killed in the same region. Somalia's transitional federal government called on aid agencies today to use Kenyan border towns to distribute aid. Mohamed Yusuf has more.
The call comes as Somalis living along the border face starvation. Somali government forces recently seized control of the region from al-Shabaab militants. Now the rebels have blocked delivery trucks from reaching the towns. Mohamed Ali Noor is a Somali ambassador to Kenya. He says the humanitarian crisis is becoming more dire by the day.
We want the international organizations from Kenya side go into Somalia through the border towns in the control of the government. It will be easier for them to go through here so that the aid goes to the people.
Southern Somalia is the most affected region and virtually no aid is reaching communities. Aid groups have been unable to work in the area after being banned by Al-Shabaab. Mohammed Yusuf, FSRN, Nairobi.
The U.S. Supreme Court issued an 11th-hour stay of execution for a man who is set to be killed tonight. It's the second reprieve for Cleve Foster. He was spared hours before his death was scheduled in January. Foster was convicted of the 1991 murder of Nianur Mary Paul in Fort Worth. Foster says he's innocent and appealed his execution based on ineffective counsel claims, as well as issues revolving around the drugs used in executions. Voters in Wisconsin went to the polls in droves today, where there's one statewide contest with huge significance for Governor Scott Walker's recent labor-busting legislation. Molly Stentz from WORT in Madison has more.
Election officials predict that the city of Madison will see a record 60% turnout by the end of the day. Voters are fired up about the Supreme Court race. The conservative majority on the court hinges on one judge, and that's the judge who's up for election today. Many protesters who've been at the state capitol over the past 2 months have focused their attention on trying to unseat this judge, Judge Prosser. They fear a conservative Supreme Court will allow the governor's legislation to proceed, and public employees will lose much of their collective bargaining rights. Despite new restrictions on freedom of speech at the state capitol, members of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign held a citizens' vigil there today to deplore the influence of money in elections.
Money is not speech. Corporations are not people. Elections are not auctions. And public offices are not commodities to be bought and sold.
Also on the ballot in Madison and Dane County were two advisory referenda to amend the U.S. Constitution and declare that corporations are not people. Two local taxicab companies have offered free rides to the polls. Molly Stentz, FSRN, Madison.
For Free Speech Radio News from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Danny Wood in San Francisco. Ivory Coast's incumbent leader, Laurent Gbagbo, is negotiating his surrender and handover of power. A government spokesperson told Reuters that they're discussing with French officials judicial and security conditions for Gbagbo's camp and his relatives. Earlier today, several of Gbagbo's military leaders called for a ceasefire, while forces loyal to the recognized president, Alassane Ouattara, surrounded Gbagbo's presidential palace in the capital, Abidjan. YJ Choi, head of the UN operations in Ivory Coast, told Al Jazeera that Laurent Gbagbo is ready to give up.
Globally, the war is over. Top leaders of Mr. Gbagbo, including himself, expressed their readiness to end the war. He has been abandoned by all his advisors and generals. He's alone with his handful of family members and aides in his bunker basement, and he is ready to surrender. There is no two armies, there is only one army, pro-Ouattara's army, that's all. The other simply melted away.
Choi said the problem now was how to quickly re-establish law and order. But questions are being raised about whether the UN and French troops exceeded their mandate, firing rockets at Gbagbo's presidential palace and military camps in Abidjan. The humanitarian problem remains critical, with many hundreds dead and thousands without food or water. Stephen Anderson from the International Committee of the Red Cross said the security situation for civilians and humanitarian workers remains a concern.
We'll put the needs of people first and we'll do our best to come to their help. We also have heard that a number of neighborhoods have been cut off from water, electric supply, so this may be one of the first things that we'll need to do so that people have access to water. Because, of course, with no water and no food, that's another issue. The needs, of course, of the people are really enormous.
Ouattara's forces ordered a curfew for most of the day and night, and Doctors Without Borders says their medical teams continue to struggle to treat civilians wounded during the past several days of intense fighting. Japanese officials are testing playgrounds at hundreds of schools today for radioactive contamination. Officials with the Tokyo Electric Power Company are also offering condolence money to local governments. At least one city has said no thanks, and local mayors are pressing Prime Minister Naoto Kan for dramatically increased support. And today, India announced a moratorium on all produce and processed food from Japan. As the Fukushima nuclear crisis continues, residents in the Pacific Northwest are expressing a renewed concern about cleanup at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. At a recent public meeting in Portland, Oregon about Hanford, the situation with Japan's stricken nuclear reactor was not specifically on the agenda, but it was certainly on the minds of many of those who attended. FSRN's David Rosenfeld has this report.
Officials with the Department of Energy, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and the Washington Department of Ecology say the nation's largest environmental cleanup is proceeding on schedule. Eric Olds, a spokesperson with the Federal Energy Department, said the cleanup at Hanford involving millions of gallons of highly radioactive waste and the debate around nuclear energy are two different things.
What people do need to understand is that what we do at Hanford, which is cleanup, is very different than what's going on in Japan. That's an issue with a commercial nuclear reactor that produces power. At Hanford, we're doing a cleanup, and that's all the legacy, the leftover from weapons production that occurred at the Hanford site. And really, the message that we want people to walk away with is those are really different things. And what we do at Hanford, we're making a lot of progress there in the cleanup. In the last 20 years, we've made a huge amount of progress.
Up until the 1980s, nuclear reactors along the Columbia River, about 200 miles from here, produced the vast majority of plutonium that fueled America's nuclear weapons stockpile. Now, much of that waste left over threatens the Columbia River. But residents are also concerned about the Columbia Generating Station, a commercial nuclear power plant adjacent to the Hanford site. David Hess is with the Progressive Party of Oregon.
The disaster in Japan reinforced our belief that this type of power is dangerous. You know, when people refer to nuclear power as clean power, of course, that's absurd. There's nothing clean about it. You know, because you can't taste it, because you can't smell it, because you can't see it, doesn't make it clean. It will still kill you. You know, it's still highly toxic. And so, you know, that's why we oppose nuclear power, you know, and we say that that money that's being spent, you know, to develop more nuclear sites should be diverted to clean energy solutions.
Tom Carpenter heads Hanford Challenge, a nonprofit watchdog organization based in Seattle.
We can't tolerate a situation like what we're seeing in Japan, where nuclear materials are released into the environment and people get sick and killed from that.
He said not enough people know about what's going on at Hanford.
They assume that because production era at the Hanford site is over, that it's okay, but actually we have this very large legacy of nuclear waste that has yet to be secured. They're in leaky tanks. They're trying to build structures and facilities to take care of that. But we're in a race against time to save the river.
Officials plan to use the feedback they received from this and two other public meetings to set priorities for next year's federal budget for Hanford cleanup, which so far, they say, is $450 million short of what they need. David Rosenfeld, FSRN, Portland.
Today, civil liberties groups are calling on President Barack Obama to veto any bill that reauthorizes three controversial provisions of the Patriot Act, which expire at the end of May. Critics are opposed to Section 215, which authorizes the FBI to secretly obtain internet, financial, and other personal records of American citizens. The so-called lone wolf provision, which allows secret surveillance of non-US citizens who haven't been connected to a terrorist group. And the roving wiretap provision, which permits broad surveillance of communications, including phones and emails, without identification of a specific target. For more, we go to Mark Rumold, legal fellow with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who've investigated the use of these expiring provisions and say they've uncovered possible abuses of the law. Mark Rumold, welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, you received about 2,500 pages of documents after filing a Freedom of Information Act request with the FBI for information on abuses of the Patriot Act. Despite being heavily redacted, you discovered some intelligence violations. Tell us about what you found.
In 2009, we filed a request specifically for abuses stemming from the FBI's use of the Patriot Act. And then in a separate FOIA request, we asked for all reports of intelligence violations committed by the FBI that they submitted to the Intelligence Oversight Board, which is an executive-level board that is charged with overseeing intelligence. What we received from the Patriot Act FOIA request, it was a little unclear what we were looking at because the documents were so heavily redacted. What we were able to find was an email that said IOB database roving authority, which suggests that this was the IOB reports that were listed in this email stemmed from the FBI's use of the roving wiretap authority, which is one of the FBI, or one of the expiring provisions in the Patriot Act. Now, when we cross-checked that IOB number that was in that email with the response from the other FOIA request, we were able to find a more substantial description of the violation, which while the details are still unclear, it appears that in a case where roving authority was either utilized or authority had been granted, that the FBI monitored conversations of what looks to be children for up to 5 days.
Do we have any idea why they might have been trying to justify doing that?
From the looks of it, it appears that they were attempting to monitor some type of known either foreign agent or terrorist. And in the course of that, either their wiretap, they submitted a number that was, you know, drafted incorrectly or was clearly unrelated to their investigation, and they ended up monitoring children.
How exactly are you telling this from these documents? They have crosses and empty boxes on them. Is it particularly difficult to cross-check and reference and compare these documents? It must have been quite a job.
Well, so in the Patriot Act FOIA that we received, all we had was a one line in an email that said potential IOB matter 2005-160. And everything else about that potential IOB matter was redacted. When we went back and looked in the earlier request, we were able to use that number, 2005-160, in order to kind of match up the violation.
And so what you were finding was quite a discrepancy then between the two documents, even though they should have presumably been exactly the same?
Well, the first document was just an email, so it shouldn't necessarily have been the same, but there was a description of the violation in the email that was entirely redacted. So without this other FOIA request, it wouldn't have made any sense. We wouldn't have known what had happened or, you know, what the circumstances were giving rise to the violation.
Tell us about some of the other documents you received and what they might have been indicating could have been going on in terms of possible violations of the Patriot Act.
The other documents that we received in the Patriot Act request were so redacted that we couldn't tell. We couldn't tell what happened. But we know from statements made by former Senator Feingold and from a report put together by the Inspector General of the Department of Justice that Section 215, another expiring provision of the Patriot Act, has been abused in the past.
You're running a campaign today asking people to call the White House to get the Patriot Act changed. So what checks and balances would you like to see?
What we're doing today is we're encouraging people to call the White House. Today marks it's the anniversary of the first time that a bill was vetoed by George Washington in 1792. So we're asking President Obama to veto any Patriot Act renewal that is just a straight-up renewal. What we'd like to see are some types of oversight built into any renewal, safeguards, auditing, those types of things.
Mark Rumold, Legal Fellow with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, thanks very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
Yeah, thank you.
In the US, laws requiring greater identification requirements for voters are cropping up in almost half of states nationwide. While supporters say voter ID laws are necessary to avoid fraud, voting rights advocates say the laws could disenfranchise minorities and low-income voters. Michael Lawson has more.
A new voter ID bill in Ohio, considered the most restrictive in the nation, requires a driver's license, state identification, military ID, or passport to vote. A free ID would be issued to voters who may not be able to afford one if they qualify. The Ohio law, HB 159, would also prohibit the use of public university student IDs, an allowance made in other states that require photo ID. A Houston-based Tea Party-affiliated organization, True the Vote, held a national summit on a recent weekend that was billed as nonpartisan and in support of free and fair elections. The summit's speakers included Andrew Breitbart, John Fund, and Heritage Foundation fellow and former Bush administration official Hans von Spankowski, who pushed back at the idea that voter ID laws can suppress votes.
The reason they use that kind of a personal attack and that kind of language is because they can't argue with us substantively on the issue. Why? Well, for example, the last Rasmussen poll I saw on voter ID showed that 82% of the American people support voter ID.
While poll numbers do show large support for some voter identification requirement, opponents say the voter fraud hysteria is overblown. An investigation by the Bush Justice Department found only 86 voter fraud convictions over a five-year span, most of which could not have been prevented with additional ID requirements. Voting rights advocates frequently cite the effects that voter ID laws have on minorities, low-income voters, and students because of lack of photo identification. However, Demos also found 18% of citizens over the age of 65 do not possess photo identification as well. Besides actual IDs, access to documents required to obtain an ID are an area of concern as well. Estelle Rogers, director of advocacy with the Washington-based organization Project Vote, says various segments of the population face the threat of disenfranchisement through voter ID laws.
The elderly have a tremendous impact from this, often because they don't have birth certificates or can't locate them. When you talk about people who, for example, come from rural backgrounds and were possibly born in their parents' home, a birth certificate often was never issued or is long gone.
Voter ID laws are also costly. And in Texas, lawmakers passed a voter ID bill through the House expected to cost $2 million, while also passing a controversial budget that contained sweeping cuts to public education and health care. Rogers, with Project Vote, says these are misaligned motives and adds that many state estimates don't consider all cost of voter ID laws.
I mean, that's one of the manifestations, I think, of the short-term folly of this, is that there are fiscal estimates that vary from, like $2 to $20 million over a period of a couple of years to implement this, and that doesn't even talk about the upkeep of the new procedures.
Rogers says that in addition to production of free IDs, states and municipalities also will have to pay for reprinting of new forms, extensive voter education about the new rules, and additional poll worker training, among other things. The Supreme Court upheld Indiana's voter ID law passed in 2005 because of the inability to show actual disenfranchisement, but left the door open to other challenges to voter ID laws. But a number of other states, including Texas, are subject to the Voting Rights Act, which means any changes to voting laws must be reviewed by the U.S. Justice Department to ensure they do not discriminate against minorities. Michael Lawson, FSRN, Washington.
The case of the so-called Angola 3 hits Washington, D.C. tomorrow as three lawmakers lend their support to the trio's two remaining members still held in solitary confinement. Congress members John Conyers, Bobby Scott, and Cedric Richmond are holding a briefing on solitary confinement, followed by a screening of the documentary In the Land of the Free about the Angola 3. Advocates are increasing awareness in anticipation of what might be Albert Woodfox's last appeal later this year. FSRN Stephen Mather reports from London, where Robert King, the only freed member of the Angola 3, recently travelled to promote the screening of the documentary in the UK.
The campaign to free the two remaining incarcerated members of the Angola 3 reaches a critical stage this summer as one of the men will appear in court for what could be his last chance for freedom. the three men spent decades in solitary confinement following the murder of prison guard Brent Miller back in 1972. They have always maintained their innocence, saying they were framed because of their political activities, which included organising a prison chapter of the Black Panther Party and staging hunger strikes and sit-ins to push for better conditions. Robert H. King was the first of the three men to be released after serving 31 years, 21 of those in solitary confinement. He got out in 2001. He has worked tirelessly ever since to get the other two, Albert Woodfox and Herman Wallace, out of jail.
Both men now been in prison for more than 40 years, 39 or more in solitary confinement, both convicted for a crime in which neither committed.
King says they were convicted on the words of another prisoner who was rewarded by the regime for his testimony.
Physical evidence that they found a knife that did not have a print on it that matched anybody, but they did find a print, a handprint, you know, that did not match neither of the people who were subsequently charged, and this was suppressed.
Wallace's appeal is still in the lower courts, but a final hearing is to be heard this summer for Woodfox. Tori Pegram is the campaign coordinator for the International Campaign to Free the Angola 3 and spokesperson for Woodfox's legal team.
Albert's conviction has actually been overturned twice since he was originally convicted. And both of those judges have cited sort of racial discrimination, prosecutorial misconduct, inadequate defense, and suppression of exculpatory evidence, which means they, you know, kept things secret that could have exonerated him during the process.
The state of Louisiana and current Attorney General James Buddy Caldwell opposes the release of Woodfox and Wallace. Caldwell has called Woodfox the most dangerous man on the planet. Woodfox's lawyers will be claiming that the jury that originally convicted him wasn't chosen to non-discriminatory practice. If it fails, he will likely remain in prison for the rest of his life. However, Pegram is cautiously optimistic this time round.
If it can be shown, which of course Albert is seeking to do, that there was discrimination, being that, you know, women and minorities were not properly considered for the position of foreperson in his grand jury, the jury that was responsible for determining whether or not he should go to trial a second time for the same crime, then they have very little room with which to sort of reverse that decision.
Because of King's campaign and the decades-old grassroots movement behind the prisoners, Free the Angola 3 has now reached Washington, D.C. Three U.S. Congress members, John Conyers, Cedric Richmond and Bobby Scott, are calling for justice for Woodfox and Wallace. And the documentary telling their story, In the Land of the Free, will be shown on Capitol Hill on April 6th. Stephen Mather, FSRN.
And that's it for the program today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Michael Lawson. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rosh Katapchi and Scott Pham. FSRN welcomes your questions, comments and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.